Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 114. It's Monday, May 17th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, we have some really good breaking news in this last week. Vaccinations have been approved for 12 to 15-year-olds, and this is really important for two reasons. One, it can help get our middle school, late middle school, and high school students back in the fall, and also it can be another boost towards the total amount of vaccinations and herd immunity we may be able to attain as a country. Woohoo! In other big news, of those vaccinated, the CDC recommendation now allows no mask use in many situations. Still, over half the U.S. population is completely unvaccinated, unprotected, and should wear masks in many, many situations, as previously recommended. Okay, the four of you, fortunately, the ones who are vaccinated, we have this from The Hill. Fauci says vaccinated people become, quote, dead ends for the coronavirus. Appearing on CBC's Face the Nation, Fauci explained to host John Dickerson that fully vaccinated people can go without masks even if they have an asymptomatic case of COVID-19 because the level of virus is much lower in the nasopharynx, the top part of the throat that lies behind the nose, than it is in someone who is unvaccinated. So even though there are breakthrough infections with vaccinated people, almost always the people are asymptomatic, and the level of virus is so low it makes it extremely unlikely, not impossible, but very, very low likelihood that they are going to transmit it, Fauci said. He added that vaccinated people essentially become dead ends for the virus to spread within their communities. When you get vaccinated, you not only protect your own health and that of the family, but also you contribute to the community health by preventing the spread of the virus throughout the community. In other words, you become a dead end to the virus, and when there are a lot of dead ends around, the virus is not going to go anywhere. And that's when you get to a point that you have a markedly diminished rate of infection in a community. Fauci said he hopes that the CDC's relaxation of mask guidelines encourages those who had not yet been vaccinated to go and get the shot. And next up is a sampling of some of the science behind such statements. This from Science Daily. COVID-19 vaccine is associated with fewer asymptomatic SARS-CoV-2 infections. Vaccination dramatically reduced COVID-19 symptomatic and asymptomatic infections in St. Jude Children's Research Hospital employees compared with their unvaccinated peers, according to a research letter that appears in the Journal of the American Medical Association. A week or more after receiving the second dose, vaccinated employees were 96% less likely than unvaccinated workers to become infected. When researchers looked at asymptomatic infections, vaccination reduced the risk by 90%. Woohoo! Okay, but the gap between science and practice is the confusion that when people hear and see masks going off, people aren't necessarily following the rules according to the CDC guidance. In other words, people who are unvaccinated assume that's just a free-for-all now, the pandemic's over and all the mitigation efforts are over. This is not true. This is one reaction to the CDC policy change from an epidemiologist. This from the blog Your Local Epidemiologist. Today, the CDC dropped mask requirements in the vast majority of spaces. Here are my initial thoughts. One, I don't think removing a mask requirement will improve vaccine hesitancy in the U.S. Maybe a little, but nothing meaningful. I'm in the weeds with the community. Wearing a mask doesn't even land in the top 20 reasons people won't get a vaccine. Two, this relies on an honor system, which will crumble. This puts the onus on businesses to endorse and enforce, and this will make masks even more politicized. Three, there are much smarter de-implementation strategies we could have gone with, like reaching the critical threshold of 59% and or until every American has at least had an opportunity to get a vaccine, and or at least waited until transmission calmed down so this virus stops mutating. There are only 4 states with moderate transmission, 0 states with mild transmission. Editorial note, that means there's 46 states with high transmission, including Ohio. 4. I wouldn't be surprised if we had another wave this summer. 5. Someone should write a book about the implementation, de-implementation, and scientific communication downfalls of the U.S. during a global pandemic. 6. I'll still be wearing my mask inside. For my daughters, for my best friend who is immunocompromised, and until we can get this beast under control. And once we get there, I'll be the first to have a massive mask-burning bonfire. Maybe I'm being too careful. Maybe I'm a sheep, but quite frankly, I don't care. Bottom line, it was too soon, and this should be interesting. Love, your local epidemiologist. Okay, well, things are changing fast for the better, so you need to pay attention to all this. This from the Hill. CDC director defends new mask guidance, saying science, quote, evolved. During an appearance on ABC's This Week, Director Walensky told host Martha Raddatz, that as recently as 2 weeks ago, vaccines had proved to be effective enough to not require those who were fully vaccinated to have to wear face coverings. We now have science that has really just evolved, even in the last 2 weeks, that demonstrates that these vaccines are safe, they are effective. They are working in a population just as they did in the clinical trials, that they are working against our variants that we have here circulating in the United States. Walensky also told Raddatz that with the latest guidelines, unvaccinated people should still follow mask guidance, and that the new recommendations did not mean that there should be, quote, a widespread removal of masks. Walensky added that it might take some time for people to adjust to the new guidelines, and that decisions on mask wearing should be made on the local level. We also need to say that this is not permission for widespread removal of masks. For those who are vaccinated, it may take some time for them to feel comfortable removing their masks, but also that these decisions have to be made at the jurisdictional level, at the community level. Some communities have been hit harder than others, have lowered vaccination rates than others, Walensky said. We want to deliver the science of the individual level, but we also understand that these decisions have to be made at the community level. Next up from the Hill, new mask guidance puts onus on businesses. New federal guidance on mask wearing is putting businesses and local officials in a tough spot. In a dramatic about-face, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advised last Thursday that fully vaccinated Americans don't have to wear masks or practice physical distancing in most settings. We have all longed for this moment when we can get back to some sense of normalcy, the CDC director said during a White House news conference, but the announcement caught many off guard and raised a host of questions about how new policies would be implemented. States and cities were left scrambling to figure out whether to change their own rules to match the new federal advice. Health experts, business leaders, and labor groups said the new recommendations are too ambiguous and warned that a lack of consistency across different sectors is concerning and dangerous. There's no way to tell who is vaccinated and who is not without asking for proof. The federal government has ruled out any sort of national passport, instead leaving it up to individual businesses. Millions of Americans are doing the right thing and getting vaccinated, but essential workers are still forced to play mask police for shoppers who are unvaccinated and refuse to follow local COVID safety measures. Are they now supposed to become the vaccination police? Mark Perrone, president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, said in a statement. Perrone criticized the CDC for failing to take into account the essential workers who face frequent exposure to individuals who are not vaccinated and refuse to wear masks. With so many states already ending their mask mandates, this new CDC guidance must do more to acknowledge the real and daily challenge these workers and the American people still face, he said. Lawrence Gostin, a professor of global health law at Georgetown University, said it's too much of a burden to expect businesses to try and require proof of vaccination without any kind of technical guidance or support. I think particularly with a small or medium-sized employer, you can't expect them to figure out how to do a vaccine certificate system, Gostin said. The CDC is telling the public and the private sector that they have to make a very sharp differentiation between vaccinated and unvaccinated people, and yet the federal government stubbornly refuses to help businesses to gain proof of vaccination status, he added. Even large retailers could be placed in a difficult position, either to enforce an existing mask mandate or to check for customers' vaccination status. We know what's happened throughout the pandemic when the federal government just took a hands-off approach. You have inconsistency, haphazardness, and confusion. Confusion, Gostin said. Trader Joe's became the first grocery chain last Friday to announce they will allow fully vaccinated customers to not wear a mask while shopping. Like Walmart, the company did not specify any process to check if a customer without a mask on is vaccinated. Other major retailers have said they will stick with their own coronavirus mitigation measures following incidents of altercations with store and restaurant employees over the past year. The new guidance may also pose challenges for industries hit hard by the pandemic that have struggled to attract enough workers to meet rising consumer demand. Restaurants, bars, retailers, and rideshare companies have all reported difficulties rehiring staff with the U.S. economy kicking back into pre-pandemic activities. While Republican lawmakers and business groups have blamed expanded unemployment benefits for disincentivizing work, many job seekers say they remain uncomfortable returning to close contact jobs with only about a third of U.S. adults fully vaccinated. And while 12 to 15-year-olds can now get vaccinated, very few of them are, yet many schools are now ditching the mask requirements. This from the Associated Press. Schools ditch student mask requirements in growing numbers. As a lengthy, bitter fight over mask requirements for students neared its conclusion, the chairperson of a Florida school board announced that she would agree to lift a mandate that has been in place since September, even though she preferred leaving it in place until the end of the academic year. Parents hurled insults in response. Communist, Democrat, opponents of making children wearing masks in schools shouted as board chair Wee Ubershauer and the district superintendent explained at a May 3rd meeting that was still that they still considered masks advisable. This is Santa Rosa County, America, not China, they shouted. Moments later, the Santa Rosa School Board voted unanimously to make masks optional for all grades effective immediately, joining dozens of other U.S. communities in declaring that masks were or would be soon no longer be mandatory for students. The debates have been emotionally and highly divisive around the country, in some cases leading to the involvement of police. A few beleaguered school boards, caught between the demands of anti-mask parents and the appeals of employee unions, eliminated student mask rules only to reverse or revise the decisions, where many see a continued need to protect children who aren't vaccinated against COVID-19. Opponents argue that masks make students uncomfortable and mandates impinge on freedom. The dust-ups highlight competing risk narratives 14 months into the pandemic. Even as a number of U.S. schools remain closed to minimize infections, districts and states from Alabama to Wyoming decided to ditch student mask mandates. Many more are likely to do the same before the next school year starts, despite the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidance that schools, quote, should prioritize universal and correct use of masks and physical distancing. Some public health experts are alarmed. While the Food and Drug Administration has approved Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children as young as 12, it's unlikely that many young adolescents will be vaccinated before the end of the academic year. Data from the CDC shows infection rates among U.S. residents ages 14 to 17 are now higher than for all Americans, while the rates among children 6 to 13 are getting closer to the national average. We know that masks work to reduce transmission, Gigi Granville, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, said. This is really not the time to remove one of the best tools we have to reduce transmission. And even with all that confusion, parents are becoming more comfortable with kids going back to school. This from The Hill. Nearly 3 in 4 parents comfortable with in-person learning in the fall. U.S. parents are broadly confident in the ability of schools to keep their children safe from COVID-19, a new poll suggests. The Hart Research Survey released last Wednesday found that nearly 3 in 4 parents polled, 73%, would support their school districts returning for a fully in-person school year in the fall, while 17% were unsure and just 10% said that hybrid or remote classes were still necessary. An even wider majority, 90%, said they were confident that their school district, quote, will take the steps necessary to keep students safe in the fall, an increase from 73% who said the same before the beginning of the 2021 school year. Despite the wide agreement that in-person learning will be safe for most students, 85% of parents agreed in the poll that those in high-risk categories should be allowed to complete remote learning courses until they are vaccinated. 82% said the same for teachers and staffers in high-risk categories. Other specific safety measures also found widespread support in the poll. Another 78% of respondents agreed that students and teachers should wear face masks full-time while indoors and train staff and students on the use of personal protective equipment. The poll found 83% said that personal protective equipment should be provided for students and staff at schools, and 77% said that voluntary vaccination should be offered at school buildings. The number of parents comfortable with fully in-person learning rises to 94%, according to the poll, if all of the above safety measures and others, including improving indoor ventilation systems and mandating social distancing, were guaranteed to be implemented. But, of course, in the meantime, we're ditching mask use for a lot of unvaccinated in practice. Not a good thing. But, and vaccinations are rolling along, but going slower and slower. But there are states and communities that are trying all kinds of different things. This one from Ohio, from the Hill. Ohio to use millions in federal funds for vaccine lottery giveaways. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine announced last Wednesday the state will give away millions of dollars in federal funds through a lottery for people who have received the coronavirus vaccine in an effort to incentivize more Ohioans to get vaccinated. According to DeWine, Ohioans aged 18 and older who have received at least one dose of the coronavirus vaccine will be entered automatically into a lottery to win $1 million. Beginning May 26th, there will be a total of five weekly drawings, with each winner receiving $1 million. Ohioans under the age of 18 who are eligible to receive a vaccine will be entered into a separate drawing for the chance to win a four-year full scholarship to any of Ohio State's colleges and universities, including full tuition, room, and board. The winning payouts will be funded by existing federal coronavirus relief funds, according to DeWine. The pool of names entered into the lottery will be obtained from the Ohio Secretary of State's public available voter registration database, DeWine said. There will, however, be a webpage for people to sign up for the lottery if they are not in the database being used by the state. So, editorial note there. If you are not registered to vote, you will not be automatically added, and you'll need to go to that webpage. I know that some may say, DeWine, you're crazy. This multi-million dollar drawing idea of yours is a waste of money. But truly, the real waste at this point in the pandemic, when the vaccine is readily available to anyone who wants it, is a life lost to COVID-19, DeWine wrote on Twitter. Okay, and while folks around the country are trying anything to get vaccination rates up, throwing everything against the wall and see what sticks, here's a story from ABC News. Here's how effective vaccine incentives like free beer really are. With vaccination numbers declining across the country, leaders in various states are scrambling to put a stick and a carrot in front of the millions of residents who have yet to get the shots. From free beers and baseball tickets to a raffle for a car and even cash, governors and city leaders are attempting to encourage those on the fence to roll up their sleeves. But so far, states have not seen upticks in their vaccine administrations, according to the data from the CDC. Health experts told ABC News that such incentives rarely make a large, lasting impact on healthy behaviors or public health initiatives. Emily Largent, an assistant professor of medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, said Americans who are holding out on getting a vaccine are ones who have misgivings behind the science, are misinformed, or have other personal reasons. A donut or a ticket is not going to address their concern, she told ABC News. We're still going to need other interventions. Still, Largent and other health experts say the incentives could make a dent in the vaccination numbers if they are combined with targeted messaging at those groups. A recent ABC News Washington Post poll found that nearly 1 in 4 Americans are still disinclined to get vaccinated. Companies such as Krispy Kreme offered freebies to vaccinated customers in March, and elected officials throughout the country followed suit in the last few weeks as lines outside vaccination centers decreased. On April 26, Connecticut announced a promotion to give free beers at participating bars and breweries to vaccinated residents between May 19th and May 31st. On April 28, West Virginia Governor Jim Justice announced that any state resident between 16 and 35 would receive a state savings bond if they received a vaccination. The government-run promotions ramped up last week. In Memphis, Tennessee city leaders began a sweepstakes for a free card to any resident who has been vaccinated. On May 4th, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy also offered a free beer promotion to residents who received their first shot this month. A day later, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo began a promotion that would provide free tickets to Met games from May 24th through June 17th and to Yankee games from May 7th through June 6th for newly vaccinated people, along with another promotion that gave residents free weekly subway passes. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine made a major announcement offering $1 million a week to vaccinated winner of a raffle. After New Jersey started its shots and a beer promotion, people began lining up outside the Bolero Snort Brewery for their free pints, proudly waving their vaccination cards. It's a way for breweries to give back and do what we can to help spread the word that vaccines are available and safe. And the sooner we get shots into everyone's arm, the quicker we get everything back to normal. Dr. Kevin Shulman, a professor of medicine and economics at Stanford University School of Medicine and Graduate School of Business, told ABC News that the country is at a point where it needs to address and target the Americans who are most reluctant to get the vaccine. Financial incentives are fine as a component of a marketing strategy, but they are just a component, he said. Shulman co-authored a study in the New England Journal of Medicine in January that looked at the best ways to promote the COVID-19 vaccination among the populace. One of the recommendations in the paper was to create motivations based on fear of missing out, such as family get-togethers or movies in person. Health departments now have the data for which groups of Americans are most on the fence about the vaccine, Shulman said, and it's generally more politically conservative-leaning Americans and younger Americans. We need things that are specifically focused on these segments of the population, he said. Shulman said that states need to focus on a comprehensive marketing plan to get their vaccination numbers up. While he acknowledged that the state and federal leaders don't have the luxury of time to develop a strategy like other businesses do, the leaders must divert as many resources as they can to the messaging efforts. We have the most important product of our lifetime and have done very little research on how to market across segments, he said. Well, personally, for the $5 million lottery thing in Ohio, I would have preferred if that money had been used directly for a program to reach out to people, such as even taking vaccinations to people's homes if they request one, for instance. But given the cost of COVID-19 on society, even though it may not be the best intervention, who knows, it may very well actually be cost effective. And a variety of things in the toolbox is always a good idea and can be part of a comprehensive plan. Okay, well, let's get to the local COVID-19 update. We continue to have pretty good news. The Lucas County average daily number of cases over the last couple weeks has dropped from 100 per day down to 63. Now, I didn't do a local report last week because I was out of town and pre-recorded the show, but that's a large decrease. Woohoo for Ohio. And to see that this is happening across the state, now the majority of Ohio counties have dropped out of the high incidence category. That's 42 of 88 counties still have high incidence, but that's over half the counties that are now out. And over those two-week period, 27 counties dropped out of the high incidence. Now, of course, as a state, we are solidly in the high incidence, and we're nowhere near the 50 per 100,000 that Governor DeWine wanted to do to remove the mask things, but I think he's working on something else. He's just going to take out the requirements regardless. He's just setting a date and doing it. So much for metrics. Well, but things are moving well. In Lucas County, the positivity rate for testing, those people who get tested, what percent of them actually test positive, over the last couple of weeks, it's dropped down to 5.8%. From 2 weeks ago, it's 7.5%. This is still quite a bit higher than the state, which dropped modestly over the last couple of weeks from 3.8% to 3.5%. And over the last couple of weeks, active COVID-19 cases in nursing homes has dropped down to 10 cases, 2 residents and 8 staff. This is not quite a low. We had 3 weeks a couple months ago that were actually lower than this, but it's a big drop from the 30 or so that have been happening in the several weeks ago. And new hospitalizations are trending down steadily in both Lucas County and Ohio in recent weeks. The Lucas County death rate of the last 14 days, with 11 deaths, is higher than the state rate and similar now to the national death rate. UT closed out the school year on a good note. In the last week of school, they only had one case identified, and they had zero positivity in their surveillance testing of people at random. Way to go, University of Toledo. Lucas County schools are still having a significant number of infections at the end of the year here, but it is down from a couple weeks ago by about half. We had 8 staff and 61 students with reported COVID-19 infections in the most recent week. Okay, vaccines in the U.S., 47.3% of the U.S. population has gotten one or more doses. It looks like Ohio and Lucas County, though, are falling farther behind from the U.S. as a whole. While the U.S. has had 47.3% of the population vaccinated, Ohio's had 42.7%, and Lucas County has had 41.8%. So that means Ohio is not performing as well, and Lucas County is doing even worse relative to nationally. So since we had that inflection point from when people were knocking down the door to get vaccinated to now dealing with a somewhat reluctant or difficult to find and get access to, we see that in the last 4 weeks, the vaccination rate has gone up 7.8% in the U.S. as a whole. In Ohio, that's only gone up 5.3%, or about two-thirds of the national rate. And it's over those 4 weeks, has only gone up 4.4% in Lucas County in the last 4 weeks. And that's one-sixth, or 17% lower than the state rate. So we're seeing that Ohio and Lucas County, unfortunately, is starting to look more like the red state that apparently it is. And blue America is doing much better. Okay, well, I've been tracking the racial ethnic disparities in vaccinations, and we're seeing slight upticks again in the relative likelihood that black folks are getting vaccinated compared to white folks. In Lucas County, blacks are only 53% as likely to be vaccinated now as whites, and in the state, it's 63%. And again, we are improving at both the state and county level, but Lucas County is lagging from the state as a whole in these racial ethnic disparities. Okay, well, if you need to get vaccinated, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department now has a COVID-19 vaccine hotline staffed Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. to schedule, change, or cancel an appointment, or just for COVID-19 information, please feel free to call 419-213-4100, option 1. Again, 419-213-4100, option 1. You are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, in other vaccination news, this from Medical Express. Two-thirds of California prison residents offered COVID vaccine accepted at least one dose. Two-thirds of California prisoners who were offered a COVID-19 vaccine accepted at least one dose, according to a new study by researchers at the Stanford University School of Medicine. The researchers also found that nearly half of those who initially turned down a COVID-19 vaccine accepted it when it was offered to them again. The finding is an important indication that vaccine hesitancy is not necessarily fixed. Acceptance was highest among Hispanics at 73% and white incarcerated people, 72%, slightly lower among American Indian or Alaskan Native and Asian or Pacific Islanders, 68%, and substantially lower among black incarcerated people, 55%. Vaccine acceptance levels did not differ according to whether those offered had previously been infected with the coronavirus or not. And let's do a mini tour around the rest of the world, this for Medical Express. Majority of Russians not planning a vaccination. A majority of Russians are not planning to get vaccinated against the coronavirus, according to a poll released last Wednesday, highlighting the difficulty in the country's immunization campaign. According to a poll released by the Levada Center, Russia's leading independent pollster, 62% of Russians are reluctant to be vaccinated with a Sputnik jab, touted by Vladimir Putin as, quote, the world's best. Levada also said that 56% of Russians are not afraid of getting the coronavirus, adding that that figure has not changed since February. Russia has lifted nearly all restrictions against the coronavirus, and many Russians are refusing to wear masks on public transport and in other public places. The country has been among the hardest hit by COVID-19, and some experts say that Russian authorities vastly underreport coronavirus fatalities. Figures released by the country's statistic agency show that some 250,000 people have died from the coronavirus by the end of March. And to put that in perspective, Russia has less than half the population of the United States. So their official figures are sort of in line with what ours are. Of course, theirs are probably massively underreported. Ours are only moderately underreported. And while we're more apt to hear about India with its catastrophic epidemic going on right now, there are other places in the world in this pandemic that don't have it quite as bad. And for a little bit of perspective, let's look at the story from Medical Express. 16 new cases cause worry in Taiwan. Tsai says, don't panic. Taiwan's president sought to reassure the public that the government is capable of withstanding a further outbreak of COVID-19 after 16 local cases were detected. Don't you wish? The fact that we have grown accustomed to an endemic, meaning that we accept just a baseline level of COVID, is striking when you look at those other places in the world where they get literally several handfuls of cases and they're clamping down and trying to say, yes, we can deal with this outbreak. We'd just be happy to get out of the high category, which means pretty much out of control. Okay, well, coming back to America and vaccinations, this from the New York Times. They haven't gotten a COVID vaccine yet, but they aren't hesitant either. The slowdown in vaccinations across the country has been attributed to a blend of misinformation and mistrust Americans known as vaccine hesitancy. But there's an overlooked but sizable group whose reasons for remaining unvaccinated are not about opposition to the shots or even skepticism about them. According to a new U.S. Census estimate, some 30 million American adults who are open to getting a coronavirus vaccine have not managed to actually do so. Their ranks are larger than the hesitant, more than the 28 million who said they would probably or definitely not get vaccinated, and more than the 16 million who said they were unsure. And this month, as the Biden administration set a goal of 70% of adults getting at least one dose by July 4th, they becoming an official new focus of the nation's mass vaccination campaign. In addition to the doubters, President Biden said at a news briefing last week, the mission is to get the vaccine to those who are, quote, just not sure how to get where they want to go. If the attention is centered on a vaccine hesitant, these are the vaccine amenable. In interviews, their stated reasons for not getting vaccines are disparate, complex, and sometimes shifting. They are, for the most part, America's working class, contending with jobs and family obligations that make for scarce discretionary time. About half of them live in households with incomes less than $50,000 a year. Another 30% have annual household incomes between $50,000 and $100,000, according to an analysis of the census data by Justin Feldman, a social epidemiologist at Harvard. 81% do not have a college degree. Some have health issues or disabilities or face language barriers that can make getting inoculated against COVID-19 seem daunting. Others do not have a regular doctor, and some are socially isolated. Technically, they have access to the vaccine. Practically, it's not that simple. Hesitancy makes a better story because you've got controversy, said Dr. Thomas Friedan, a former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But there's a bigger problem of access than there is of hesitancy. And as I've mentioned before, this is the real work of public health, is closing that access barrier. Those that are amenable but haven't gotten it yet. Let's close that barrier, folks. Go public health. But, of course, political polarization and high levels of distrust are still a problem. This from The Hill. Nearly half of Americans don't trust CDC and FDA. That's a problem. As we hopefully see the light at the end of the COVID-19 pandemic tunnel, America appears to have a major problem. In a new survey released last week by the Harvard School of Public Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, we found that America has a trust gap when it comes to public health. We found that most Americans want to spend substantially more money on public health at the federal level and have a very high level of appreciation for the field. But at the same time, the public has extraordinarily low levels of trust in the institutions that lead this field and in the current performance of the public health system. In the middle of this public health crisis, we found that nearly half of Americans do not have high trust in the CDC or the FDA or other major public health organizations when it comes to recommendations they make to improve health. And among Republicans, trust is even lower. Only about a quarter say they have high trust in the CDC, the FDA, or their state health departments. Beyond trust, only about one-third of Americans give positive ratings to the nation's current system for protecting the public from health threats and preventing illness, down from 43% in 2009. We found 65% of Americans rate the nation's public health system as fair or poor, which is concerning in the middle of a pandemic. At the same time, Americans have increased their approval rating of the U.S. medical care system during the COVID-19 pandemic, and physicians and nurses remain as the highest sources of trust for information to improve health. We documented these low levels of trust a year into the COVID-19 pandemic, a time period when Americans collectively discovered it is significantly better to stay out of the ICU and take measures to prevent getting COVID-19 rather than be treated for it. Expanded interest in preventing illness has benefits for the field of public health, as a large majority of Americans believe the activities of public health agencies are very important to the nation's health, and there is broad support for substantially increased federal funding in public health. However, low levels of trust are related to how Americans are interpreting what is going on with the COVID-19 pandemic, how it affects their everyday lives, and what the science is actually saying about the state of the outbreak. Low levels of trust and political polarization have made moving ahead on these critical issues extremely difficult. When looking at these polarized views around public health, it is important to recognize that part of the solution reflects the overall trends in American life, where political parties are divided on many issues, and a large share of the public doesn't trust the media as a reliable source of information, irrespective of what the facts may be. In our poll, about one-third of Americans said they think the information provided by their state health departments about the health of people in their state is unreliable, which is a problem if agencies expect a large share of people to change their health behaviors based on information provided by state health departments. And the implications for the future are clear. You cannot improve the public health system, even with more funding, until you find a way for the public to trust these institutions and the people who lead them. Well, I differ slightly on that last statement. It is definitely true that trust is an essential ingredient into an effective public health system. But frankly, some of this is embedded in the notion that it's all about individual decision making. Part of public health, in fact, one of its core functions is public policy. And a lot of the things like rules and regulations and such that are put in place that people aren't even aware of actually protect them. It's kind of like having a fire code on your house. If you have that fire code, you're actually protected. You don't actually make a choice about, do I want to make my house safe when I build a house? It's actually part of the way that we do it as a society. And it's basically taken outside of the executive functions of the brain. We have to make a trillion decisions every day about every aspect of our life. We just make some collective decisions as a society that the science shows that this is dangerous, and we are going to take a collective, reasoned, proportional response to addressing that problem to give people the best chance to live a healthy life. Okay, well, I wanted to add one little piece of information from that Robert Wood Johnson survey that I just covered. The public's perspective on the United States public health system. When asked an open-ended question about the top two biggest health problems facing the nation, the most cited health problems are COVID-19 at 59%, cancer 19%, obesity 19%, healthcare access 15%, and mental illness 10%. It'll be interesting to see how that shifts when COVID-19 is taken out or much reduced in the public health landscape. Okay, well, certainly some of the problems with public health, and as indicated in that last survey, are related to public infrastructure being weak and getting weaker over recent years and decades. This from The Hill. White House unveils plan to spend $7 billion to hire public health workers. The White House announced last Thursday that it's providing $7.4 billion of funding from the pandemic relief measure passed earlier this year to hire and train public health workers to respond to COVID-19 and future crises. The funding includes $3.4 billion for overstretched public health departments in states and localities to hire additional staff who can work on vaccination outreach, testing, contact tracing, and other tasks. The CDC and AmeriCorps will team up to launch a public health AmeriCorps with $400 million in funding to, quote, recruit and build a new workforce ready to respond to the public health needs of the nation, the White House said. At least $500 million will go towards hiring school nurses who can help in the COVID-19 vaccination effort for younger people. The CDC cleared the way for adolescents age 12 to 15 to get vaccinated, and approval for younger children could come down the line. A final $3 billion will focus on longer-term funding to modernize the public health workforce, with a new grant program focused on helping public health departments beyond the current pandemic. The funding is part of the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan that President Biden signed in March. The announced funding will allow the United States to expand its public health workforce, creating tens of thousands of jobs to support vaccinations, testing, contact tracing, and community outreach, and strengthen America's future public health infrastructure, the White House said. Local public health officials have long said that they are underfunded and overstretched, and have warned of a boom and bust cycle in which resources are not maintained once the attention from one public health scare passes. Last week, the White House also announced the release of $250 million for community outreach workers to help get people vaccinated, part of the push from Biden to get 70% of adults to have at least one shot by July 4th. Okay, well, COVID-19 has taught us a lot of things, and it's taught us a lot about the flu, somewhat by accident. This from Science Daily. The absence of a 2021 flu season shows how effective simple public health measures are at limiting virus transmission. If you did not catch the flu this year, and there's an overwhelming chance that you did not, you have COVID-19 to thank. It's a small consolation given the enormously disruptive scope of the pandemic, but it's focus of a new paper published in the journal Frontiers in Public Health by two Concordia researchers and their colleagues that study the 2020 influenza figures from Canada, the United States, Australia, and Brazil. The authors show that there's a clear relationship between the implementation of COVID mitigation measures such as hand washing, masking, and social distancing, and the spread of the annual flu. They write that these preventive measures all but eliminated the flu in countries where it can kill tens of thousands of people a year, even as cases of COVID-19 soared. In the Northern Hemisphere, we initially had overlapping flu and COVID-19 cases. When we introduced basic measures like hand washing, social distancing, and wearing masks, the flu was almost totally obliterated while COVID kept going. These findings offer lessons for public health authorities as we eye a post-COVID future. We know the flu is particularly problematic for older individuals and those with respiratory conditions and so on. When we interact with people in those high-risk brackets, we should maintain some measures like hand washing, mask wearing, and social distancing. We're used to them now, so maintaining them moving forward is probably a good idea. And tens of thousands of lives hang in the balance. Okay, next up, a public health case study of sorts from The Hill. DeSantis's cruise line battle shows contempt for public health federalism. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has manipulated federalism principles in a series of actions designed to aid the Florida cruise ship industry that are less about consistent principles and more about grabbing a headline. His actions may wind up hurting the very same industry, but they also illustrate why Congress needs to examine the proper allocations of state and federal power in a public health emergency. In October, while former President Trump was still in the White House, the CDC issued a conditional sailing order for the cruise industry that imposed certain restrictions, laboratory testing of crews, simulated cruises, and a certification process, with the goal of returning to full operations in the fall of 2021. On April 2nd, the Biden administration CDC revised and extended the rules. 2 weeks ago, Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody, in consultation with DeSantis, filed a lawsuit in federal district court in Tampa challenging the extension. At the same time that he fights federally imposed public health measures, DeSantis has contested the ability of the cruise industry to safeguard crews and passengers by requiring proof of vaccination. He has been abetted by the Republican-dominated state legislature that on April 29th passed a wide-ranging bill that would make permanent a ban on COVID-19 vaccine passports, while also handing the governor power to override local orders during health crises. The pandemic's impact on the cruise industry in Florida resulted in a loss of $3.2 billion to the state's economy through August 2020, and the loss of nearly 50,000 jobs. Rather than taking action to show he is serious about making it safe to board cruises out of the Port of Miami and other South Florida ports, DeSantis' lawsuit argues that CDC's rules damage the South Florida economy to the point of interfering with the state's sovereignty under the federal system, and that the pandemic is, in any event, waning, a claim that relies on an optimistic reading of the data. As my Georgetown Law School colleague, public health law expert Loris Gostin has predicted, the chance that the governor will prevail in court is almost zero. While there is a degree of interference with core economic functions that is protected by the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, interference with jobs is one in one private industry in Florida doesn't come close to hitting it. The lawsuit seems to be an effort mostly to embarrass the Biden administration's CDC. DeSantis went even further when he issued an executive order based on expanded emergency authorities in the new Florida bill, prohibiting the carriers themselves from making a business judgment about safety on their vessels. The order extends the ban on requiring proof of vaccination contained in the new law to any cruise ship docking in a Florida port. One cruise ship line, Norwegian Cruise Lines, has just called the governor's bluff. It has threatened to withdraw from the Florida market completely, contending it is unsafe and imprudent to sail without a vaccination requirement. Norwegian says it will transfer its operations to a U.S. state that is willing to abide by public health best practices. Norwegian Cruise Lines apparently recognizes that Florida's rule would require its crews to take life-threatening risks and potentially could expose the company to legal liability from lawsuits brought by passengers in the event of onboard COVID-19 transmission. The actions by DeSantis, state legislatures, leaders, and the Florida Attorney General illustrate a disregard for a return to normalcy for an industry that took a particular beating in the early days of the pandemic, when COVID-19 infections on the Diamond Princess became one of the first global health challenges posed by the virus. It also shows a poor understanding of who makes the rules, federal or state government, when it comes to protecting U.S. citizens from the introduction of contagious diseases through U.S. ports. The power of federal authorities to regulate travel in international waters dates to the founding of the Republic, and indeed the origins of public health. State enforced quarantines on arriving vessels from the earliest days of the colonies, and federal laws governing quarantines of vessels date to 1796. Federal power to prevent the introduction and spread of contagious diseases to the country through travel by sea is undisputed. This means that, as they apply to sea and air travel, both the vaccination passport ban and rule against mask wearing are effectively preempted by federal rules that DeSantis can't countermand. But the problems are even more fundamental. The new Florida law creates a one-way ratchet on public health emergency power for the state's governor. He can loosen restrictions, but the ability to tighten them is subject to legislative oversight. The implications for the pandemic's remaining months, and even more for a future epidemic, are worrisome, particularly if future legislators and governors are from different parties and political considerations dominate the debate on what measures are appropriate to combat illness. We know a lot about COVID-19 and its transmission, but what if the next threat is mosquito-borne, or easily aerosolized or long-lived on surfaces? One reason governors enjoy substantial emergency powers in public health emergencies is to allow nimble and flexible responses tailored to each emergency and informed by the best science as it evolves. The DeSantis approach to restarting the cruise industry in Florida shows the toxic mix that results from political ambition, coupled with disregard for science, and for the overarching role of the federal government when it comes to matters affecting U.S. sea and air borders. As part of its review of COVID-19 response, Congress will need to determine if it is wise to continue to allow the allocation of authority in public health emergencies between the states and federal agencies to be murky. It may be time to explicitly preempt state power to allow a unified, all-of-government response to the next viral threat. Okay, well, while things are looking better as a whole in the United States regarding COVID-19, there are going to be echoes of COVID-19 for a long time. This is one story that gets at that from Medical Express. Long COVID affecting more than half of patients 6 months on. Research has revealed non-hospitalized COVID-19 patients continue to present symptoms long after infection, and even more have blood biochemical abnormalities. Those symptoms include chronic fatigue, muscle and joint pain, and loss of sense of smell. This is an immensely dangerous disease that is not only costing lives today, but as we are discovering now, may have serious health consequences for some patients long into the future, even in relatively mild original cases. The research into post-acute COVID-19 syndrome, colloquially known as long COVID, shows that more than half of non-hospitalized COVID-19 patients had between 1 and 9 more persistent symptoms. What we discovered is a majority of non-hospitalized COVID-19 patients are not back to normal health or normal biochemistry 3 months on, with one or more symptoms persisting in 57% of these patients up to 6 months following the acute phase. This is a major public health concern and warrants further investigation at the national and international level. It remains unclear whether so-called long COVID is an extension of the COVID-19 disease trajectory or marks the onset of additional, separate chronic disease entities that continue to be driven by the enhanced immune response to the virus. Okay, well, let's get to a little bit of non-COVID news finally. This from Medical Express, the universe from the University of Missouri. Researchers studies rise of tick-borne diseases in Midwest. We have seen increases recently in both the number and severity of tick-borne diseases in the Midwest, particularly in the humid climates of Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas, Professor Raghavan said. Since more people get infected by tick-borne diseases each year than any other vector-borne disease, it is important that we better understand what type of ticks are present in our region, where they are located, and what time of year they are most prevalent. This information will help keep us, our families, pets, and livestock safe. Raghavan explained that several factors have contributed to the rise of tick-borne diseases. Humans are increasingly relocating from densely populated urban cities to more suburban areas on the outskirts of towns, near forests and grasslands, where ticks are often present. Outdoor fitness activities such as hiking, biking, and walking have also become more popular, especially since the COVID-19 pandemic, and particularly during the warmer spring and summer seasons in the Midwest. Climate change has played a role as well, as the warmer temperatures and humidity seem to be creating perfect conditions for ticks and the pathogens they carry to thrive. Finally, a sharp increase in population of white-tailed deer, the primary animal host for the most common tick found in the Midwest, is another contributing factor. Raghavan added that because there are currently no vaccines for tick-borne diseases, prevention practices and tick awareness are the best ways to avoid tick bites. Wearing protective clothing such as long-sleeve shirts and pants when walking outdoors or on hiking trails is highly recommended, and spraying permethrin insect repellent can help as well. Other common-sense safety practices such as staying on the main trails away from vegetation and keeping dogs on leashes can help protect you and your pets from ticks. Always check oneself and pets for any attached ticks after being outdoors. Also, visit with your doctor if you start to have any flu-like symptoms, as most tick-borne diseases are entirely curable, but early diagnosis is crucial. It is important to remember health does not operate separately for humans compared to animals or the environment. This is a one health issue, and as humans, we are just a small part of an enormous ecosystem. The more we learn and understand the problems, the better we can protect ourselves against these preventable diseases. So, watch out for ticks as we prepare for summer. Okay, well, I'd like to close the show with two air pollution stories. This from The Guardian. Asia is home to 99 of the world's 100 most vulnerable cities. Of the 100 cities worldwide most vulnerable to environmental hazards, all but one are in Asia, and 80% are in India or China, according to a risk assessment. More than 400 large cities with a total population of 1.5 billion people are at high or extreme risk because of a mix of life-shortening pollution, dwindling water supplies, deadly heat waves, natural disasters, and the climate emergency, the report found. Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, plagued by pollution, flooding, and heat waves, topped the ranking. But India, home to 13 of the world's 20 cities most at risk, may face the most daunting future of any country. Delhi ranks second on the global index of 576 cities, compiled by the business risk analyst Verisk Maplecroft. Looking only at air pollution, which causes more than 7 million premature deaths worldwide each year, including a million in India alone, the 20 cities with the worst air quality in urban areas of at least a million people are all in India. The air pollution assessment was weighted towards the impact of microscopic health-wrecking particles known as PM2.5, owing in large measure to the burning of coal and other fossil fuels. Outside Asia, the Middle East and North Africa have the largest proportion of high-risk cities across all threat categories, with Lima the only non-Asian city in the top 100. Home to more than half the world's population and a key driver of wealth, cities are already coming under serious strain from dire air quality, water scarcity, and natural hazard, said the report's lead author, Will Nichols. In many Asian countries, these hubs are going to become less hospitable as population pressures grow and climate change amplifies threats from pollution and extreme weather, threatening their role as wealth generators for national economies. China, while richer than India, faces formidable environmental challenges as well. Of the 50 cities worldwide most beset by water pollution, 35 are in China, as are all but two of the top 15 facing water stress, according to the report. But different political systems and levels of development may play in China's favor. For China, an emerging middle class is increasingly demanding cleaner air and water, which is being reflected in government targets, he said. China's top-down governance structure and willingness to take abrupt measures, such as shutting down factories to meet emission goals, gives it more of a chance of mitigating these risks. India's weaker governance, coupled with the size and scale of its informal economy, make it far harder to address environmental and climate problems at the city level, he added. When it comes to global heating and its effects, the focus shifts abruptly to sub-Saharan Africa, home to 40 of the 45 most climate-vulnerable cities on the planet. The continent will be hit the hardest not only because of droughts, heat waves, storms, and flooding, but also because it is ill-equipped to cope. Africa's two most populous cities, Lagos and Kinshasa, are among those at highest risk, the report noted. The climate index combined the threat of extreme events, human vulnerability, and the ability of countries to adapt. The report is the first in a series of risk assessments for cities and evaluates threats of livability, to livability, investment potential, real estate assets, and operational capacity. And lastly, a story that's quite literally much closer to home, this from the Washington Post. Air pollution from farms leads to 17,900 U.S. deaths per year, study finds. Animal agriculture is the worst emitter, researchers say, responsible for 80% of deaths from pollution related to food production. Gases associated with manure and animal feed produce small, lung-irritating particles capable of drifting hundreds of miles. These emissions now account for more annual deaths than pollution from coal power plants. Yet while pollution from power plants, factories, and vehicles is restricted under the Clean Air Act, there is less regulation of air quality around farms. The food system has really flown under the radar as a source of deadly pollution, said University of Minnesota professor Jason Hill, the lead author of the new report. But what we eat affects not just our own health, but the health of others. We're showing that directly. Farm pollution is most dangerous when it occurs upwind of densely populated areas, Hill said. Most of the deaths in his analysis happened in California's Central Valley, eastern North Carolina, and the Corn Belt of the upper Midwest. The most insidious kinds of air pollution are known as particulate matter 2.5, tiny particles 1/30th the width of a human hair, which can become lodged in the lungs or absorbed into the bloodstream. Exposure to PM2.5 can lead to asthma and other breathing problems, and over the long term increases the risk of dying of heart disease, cancer, and stroke. These particles are directly produced when farmers till fields or burn crops before harvest. They can also come in the form of dust kicked up by livestock in large animal feeding operations. This primary PM2.5 is associated with about 4,800 premature deaths per year, the study found. But secondary particulate matter, which is generated when emissions from farms interact with other gases in the atmosphere, is even more problematic. This is especially true for ammonia, a highly reactive molecule released by manure and fertilizer, which can combine with other pollutants such as nitrogen and sulfur compounds to create small hazardous particles. Of all pollutants, ammonia is one that has the greatest impact on mortality, Hill said. His analysis suggests that ammonia emissions contribute to about 12,400 deaths per year. This is what makes pollution from animal agriculture so dangerous, Hill added. At many beef, pork, and dairy facilities, animal waste is stored in massive lagoons. There, the microbes that break down feces release huge amounts of ammonia. Many facilities spray nitrogen-rich liquid waste on nearby farm fields, another source of contamination. Ammonia is also produced from over-application of fertilizer on such crops as corn. Because much of the nation's corn goes to animal feed, Hill counted those emissions toward animal agriculture's footprint. All those emissions add up to make meat the biggest source of deadly emissions. Per serving, the rate of air pollution deaths linked to red meat was twice as high as that of eggs, three times as high as that of dairy, and at least 15 times as high as that of all fruits and vegetables. Americans switching to a flexitarian diet, getting at least half their calories from fruits and vegetables, and limiting animal protein to just a few meals per week, air pollution mortality from agriculture would fall 68%. That cultural shift would deliver a host of other benefits. Research suggests that reducing meat consumption could reduce global mortality by 6 to 10%, preventing hundreds of thousands of premature deaths. Meat production is also the most resource-intensive form of agriculture. A whopping 30% of Earth's ice-free landmass is used for pasture for livestock, and red meat requires more water and carbon than any other food. If Earth's biggest beef eaters limited their intake to 1.5 hamburgers a week, they could avoid about 5.5 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions per year, twice the annual emissions of India. Okay, well, if you're hungering for more information, the bonus articles this week, I have six of them that you can find online. I'll give the link at the end here. First up, 7 reasons to be excited about COVID-19 vaccines for teens. 2, vaccines seem to work well against coronavirus variants. It's also complicated. 3, people aren't addicted to wearing masks, they're traumatized. 4, vaccine passports, why they are good for society. 5, new models for pandemic response can be found in existing agencies. And last but not least, 6, allow suffering to speak, treating the oppressive roots of illness. By connecting the dots between medical symptoms and patterns of injustice, we can move from simply managing suffering to delivering a lasting cure. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.